Good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio and to our Shabbat program. It looks like we have the normal cast of fellows. How are you guys, JB and Larry?
Doing good.
Real well.
Good. I'm going to ever so briefly dive into the food discussion one last time, because I think there are some things that have been resolved in email, private email discussions, many of which have been posted now on the various forums and sites. But I do want to take one last foray through it, hoping that I'm not inundated with email as a result of it, or it doesn't create too much friction. One thing was that last week, William was concerned that I was translating the passage incorrectly, which is, by the way, a good thing. You ought to be, always ought to be concerned that I'm translating something incorrectly. I would strongly encourage that. And that the clean and unclean didn't refer to the meat, but instead referred to the individuals, and so that the clean and the unclean can eat it was the thought. I guess that was what was being promoted, Larry, around the internet as a way to preclude this being an exemption.
Right. That was that was the major post that I think Marie did, and there was a bunch of fallout from it.
And I believe that Anne Marie is the individual, excuse me if I have this wrong, who wrote me an email and said that they tried diligently to translate this, and that they ended up with they wanted to know how I came up with it's the meat that's clean or unclean, and not the individuals who are clean or unclean that can eat. And so, first of all, I would like to make a general statement, and then I would like to put that part of it to bed. Why would there be any concern that there is an exception for an unclean individual? So there's no concern that there's an exemption for an unclean individual, but there is concern that there's an exemption for unclean food. That just seems pretty odd to me, that those who were upset that this seemed like a contradiction, and it isn't, it's an exemption, were bothered by the potential for a contradiction on unclean food, but not concerned about a contradiction in the instructions on hygiene and instructions on overall cleanliness. Doesn't that seem strange to you, guys? Why would you consider contradiction, and the other way it's not a contradiction?
Well, it's a contradiction either way, but I think people want to hang on to this not eating pork. I know, because, and although some people don't like me talking about FB, that's where I do most of this.
Yeah.
On FB, you see these little cutesies go by all the time. Mm-hmm. And one of the big ones you see in a picture is worms in somebody's brain because they ate bacon, or I don't eat this because I'm not filthy, and on and on and on.
You are correct.
It's just,
you are correct.
That's,
and the
all
reason
it is.
You are correct is because it's easy for someone to say, I'm not going to eat pork. Although they don't recognize how much pork product is in processed foods. But it is, I don't think anyone pays attention to the hygiene rules. So Waiyawa has more to say on personal hygiene and what is considered clean and unclean, a lot more to say. Most everyone just foregoes it. They don't go into their water bath. They pay no attention to it, but they do pay attention to pork. So one thing they can dismiss because they don't pay any attention to it, and the other they can't dismiss because they are more focused on it. So that is the answer. But what that does is say that the issue wasn't with contradiction. The issue was with a person's focus, what's important to them.
That's exactly what it is. That's all it is.
All right. And that's important.
That's
everybody ought to look at it that way, because I don't think there's a person out there that pays attention to Yahweh's instructions on hygiene or on what would be considered clean and unclean. For example, you mentioned the idea that you'd have to have your wife sleep outside in a tent a few days.
That is correct.
Yeah, and that's
right.
So, yeah, the fact is, we just don't pay attention to that, and everybody's willing to dismiss that as there is an instructive purpose for it, but not dismiss the pork under the same guise. And I just
but
want
that's
to
not
bring
the cornerstone of rabbinic Judaism,
right,
is it?
Right. That's right. Well, one is not the cornerstone of rabbinic Judaism; the other one is. Okay.
Yep.
That being the case, now beyond that. Regardless of which one it was, and we're going to nail it down which one it is, the people that are unclean or the food that's unclean, regardless, an exemption, and this is an exemption, is not a contradiction. Now, I can give you 1,000 examples of this. I don't know what that music is there, but I can give you 1,000 examples of this. One of the examples would be if someone posts a speed sign on a highway that is 65 miles an hour, and they then post a sign that says the speed limit's 45 miles an hour due to road construction. You didn't change or contradict the speed on the highway. You made an exemption for a particular period of time for a particular reason. An exemption is never a contradiction. And so the concern that Yahweh was contradicting himself, which is why I didn't respond to any of the early statements, because they all began with, I don't believe that Yahweh would contradict himself. He's not contradicting himself. An exemption is not a contradiction. All right. Those statements made, the next thing I want to clarify is that clean, if you're talking about clean and unclean individuals, is that one thing or two things? Clean and unclean.
Well, that's
one thing or
that's
two things.
Two things.
Two
different things.
Two different things. A call eat, the second use of a call eat, is prefixed and suffixed with a preposition. The prefixed supposition and the suffixed preposition are both the same. They are third person, masculine, singular. Can two things be prefixed with a singular, masculine preposition or pronoun? Doesn't the verb have to accommodate two, and the preposition have to, or the not preposition, the pronoun have to accommodate two if you're talking about two things? And this was written as masculine singular. Therefore, singular, not dual. Therefore, the only thing that can be identified in the sentence that is masculine singular is the meat. That's it, folks. The grammar does not allow someone to reconstruct this so that there is a new sentence, the clean and the unclean may eat it. It's not permissible based upon the grammar of the sentence. So that is impossible. That is not what it says, and we're not at liberty to change the pronouns because we don't like the exemption. The exemption is there.
That's right.
It is written, etched in stone from Yahweh's point of view. And it is
right.
The meat.
It's somewhat amazing that people would rather change his words than change their way of thinking about it.
Right.
This is what we're always talking about, isn't it?
Right.
You know, the family, the covenant is a laid-back situation, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't this the same covenant where Yahweh come up to Abraham and said, you're going to have a child with Sarah,
absolutely.
And Sarah smiles and says, what's this, Yahweh, miracles? And he falls on his face laughing, saying, what a bunch of nonsense.
Right.
You
yeah,
know,
and Yahweh
come on
comes
now,
and says,
guys.
You know, My response to that isn't to strike you. It isn't to say, what's wrong with you, you stupid idiot. My response, his response to that was, okay, then name the kid laughter. I mean, yes, it's a very relaxed situation. Now, I will agree that you can take Yahweh's Torah instruction at kind of any level you want. You can look at his Torah instruction as very simple instructions to children. You know, we're his children, and they're simple instructions to his children. And almost everything he has to say can be understood and appreciated as very simple instructions to young children. Or you can say that everything that he has communicated, and maybe it's not or, but and, everything that is being communicated has a profound spiritual truth that if we really carefully examine it and consider it, that we can be enlightened and come to understand beyond the simple, this is good guidance for his children. Fair enough?
Yes, mm-hmm. That's absolutely fair. And there's a lot being said there. It's sort of like when he's walking towards the mountain and he says, you're 3 days away. 3 days.
Right.
Talk about the three Moed Mikra. I mean, we can try to go, well, we should always be 3 miles away from the mountain, you know. Or we can understand that he's talking about those three Moed Mikra are going to be fulfilled.
That is correct.
Right?
Yeah, over the course of 3 days. It's the three Moed Mikra. Absolutely. All tied together in one event that established the covenant. Absolutely. And so that's one of the things I want everybody to think about. Now, the next thing I want us to think about, and this was kind of unusual, that I must have mentioned this 10 times between the shows and the emails, and yet I didn't have a single person pick up on it. Yosha's comments regarding not judging those the woman who commits adultery is resolved by the fact that he didn't say it. We know it, he didn't say it, because the first 7 centuries of manuscripts, none included. John Yahuchanan 8:1-12, I think, going by memory. But we have 2 statements that remain then. Where what Yahusha says would be in wholesale conflict with the Torah without this passage. One, he says, you know, your salvation is not a result of what you eat. What he's saying is, don't fret what you eat. Your salvation is not predicated on what you eat. And number two, he says, telling his disciples, eat whatever's put before you. Now, for him to say to his disciples, eat whatever is put before you. One is in Luke, and the other one is in Mark. For him to say that, he would be in direct violation of the Torah without this passage. With this passage, he's telling us what the Torah says. So it's a huge issue for those who try to dismiss the Torah based on something that Yosha said. This resolves that. That's a big deal, folks. And it's not something that's recorded once, but recorded twice.
Plus you have Abraham eating a cheeseburger. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I had to throw that
all
out.
Right, all right. Now, the other thing that I want to address is, so why would Yahweh make the exemption? Because that question is also asked. Why make the exemption? The exemption is for a particular period of time. It's not for all time. It's written in the perfect. So the exemption on which you can eat and eating unclean foods is for a particular period of time. Now, if you look at Yosha's comments to his disciples, that limited period of time began 2,000 years ago. Now, 2,000 years over 6,000 years is actually a limited period of time. And you have to say, why would he say it? Now, I'm not going to pretend that I know the mind of God, and I'm not going to pretend that my answer here is accurate, but it is interesting that he said it, so we should probably think, why would he say it? And my guess is, My assumption is, my conclusion is, that the reason he said it is that he did not want his disciples to come across as if they were representatives of Pharisaic Judaism. And if they were fixated on what they were eating, since that was the single most outward sign, that was the very foundation of rabbinic Judaism, if they were fixated on what they would and would not eat, it would automatically identify them with rabbinic Judaism with everyone they met with, because that was the most identifiable aspect of that religion. So my sense is that's why he said it. Now, I think there's a second reason, and that is, the second reason would be that, you know, understand that the Torah wasn't written to restrict your behavior. It wasn't written to create an obedience mentality. It was written to provide very helpful guidance, to introduce us to who Yahweh is, to explain the nature of the covenant, and to provide us with the knowledge necessary to respond to it. That's why the Torah was written. If he says, you know, eat what's put before you, then what you're doing is you're eliminating the mindset that I have to obey something to please God. And so I think that's the second.
Well, you know, he almost started it in that dinner. Remember, you could say cheese or you could say yogurt. I think your translation is yogurt, but now this is not pork, okay? But it really smashes kosher eating right there with the dinner that Yahweh ate. He didn't make a big deal out of what was to be prepared. It was Abram that said, "Go do this, go get that," and that's what they ate. And that did include a non-kosher meal, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. But, you know,
I think that was purposeful.
Right.
I think that was purposeful, too.
Kosher dining rules are rabbinic. Yahweh's instructions are, this is good for you to eat, this is not good for you to eat, and his instructions were valid. Now, there's one other aspect of the timing issue of this that is meritorious, which is that we have reached a period in time where there are foods on that list that are safer to eat than they ever have been. And so the instruction was extremely valid for most of the human experience, but there's an exemption. It's just like the highway exemption. There's an exemption when, in this case, as opposed to it being unsafe to travel at that speed, it's safe to, reasonably safe to eat something that he says, you know, that's not food. So that's the really all I care to say about it, unless somebody else has something else they want. And I guess I should add one last caveat to this whole thing. I was thrilled to find this. I was thrilled to find it because I've always said the food instructions were extremely meaningful, but time in the last 50 years has changed some of the merit of what was there.
Yes, you have said that. Yes,
yeah,
you
and
have
so
said
when
that.
I see a perfect conjugation of a verb that says Yahweh was aware of this and created an exemption for this, for me, it causes me to smile because it says, okay, yeah, God's on his game. He recognized what we recognize. God's on his game. He saw into the future and created an exemption for us. Number two.
I have a good friend from Israel, Benny Peer, that is a botanist, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Good friend. And he gave me this same lecture, by the way, about a year ago.
Oh, okay. So it's a thinking man's response, because, you know, I have studied the merit of Yahweh's food instructions, and I've gone over every item that you can identify and talked about the digestive process or its tendency to be a bottom feeder and a filter fish or whatever you may want to say. And so I know I've gone through it. I love what he had to say, and it's brilliant. But there, things have changed. Yahweh has an exemption for the change. Doesn't change Yahweh. Doesn't change Yahweh's teaching. It's you know, if Yahweh had said, you as a human should not go more than 25 miles an hour when you travel. And, you know, that might be really good advice when riding a chariot or riding in a carriage or riding on a horse or particularly riding on a camel. But, you know, now in an airplane, we can go well over 25 miles an hour and be perfectly safe. Now, Yahweh didn't give us instructions on speed, but had he would have to, the instruction would have been pertinent for a period of time, and there would have been an exemption for a later period of time. That's all this is an exemption for a later period of time. Now, the last thing I want to say about it is that I am already, and I've said this 1,000 times on the show, I'm not claiming to be right in this. I am sharing my unique perspective. I think my perspective is consistent with Dode's, and anytime you're consistent with Dode, that's a pretty good place to be, that I view everything in the Torah as teaching. I view the Torah as teaching. I view it as guidance. I view it as instruction. I do not view anything in the Torah as a law. And so I am naturally prone to celebrate passages from testimony from Yahweh that affirm that kind of approach is appropriate. So when I see it, I celebrate it because it's my natural instinct and my natural proclivity. And I've made it really clear that there's a spectrum on most things. On the spectrum between it's a hard fast rule and it's an instruction to enlighten us so we understand. You know, I'm full tilt on the instruction side. I just am. Now, that doesn't mean you all should be. You know, I'm not telling you that you all should respond the same way I do, but that is my natural proclivity in all of this. So
that is a thoughtful way to handle it, because there are about, you know, 100 things you can't do, and that's just the way it is.
100 would be, I think, a huge understatement. My guess
yeah,
is
that's
there
a way
many
understatement,
hundreds of
actually.
Things that we
how about you can't even have a Pesach lamb on
no,
Pesach?
Not the way. Not in accordance with the instructions. In fact, I can't
hear your question. I wanted to ask before we move
Pardon?
On. I just had one question. Talked about how this relates most specifically to this day and age when those foods have become not as deadly. But how then does that apply to what Yahusha said?
Yeah, well, I'm telling you is that they're different things. Yahusha created the exemption, and we could come up with why did he create the exemption. Yahusha began the time clock on that exemption, just shy of 2,000 years ago. So, and also we have the benefit now in terms of the way that food is processed and that sort of thing. So that begins another reason for the exemption. However, Yosha's exemption has nothing to do with the more proper presentation and transportation and protection of food. So that's why I took the time to say, so what was Yosha's reasons? And Yosha's reasons have nothing to do with the food becoming safer to eat. Yosha's reasons... Now, I gave you two reasons why I thought Yosha said it. One is he didn't want his disciples identified with Rabbinic Judaism, and the dietary kosher rules were the single most identifiable aspect of Rabbinic Judaism. And number two, I don't think he wanted people to view his Torah as rules to obey, and if somebody says, no, I can't eat that, then that is the implication, and he didn't want that implication. So that's why I think he said it. Now, I'm not claiming to read his mind. We know he said it, and you know, I just think it's fun. It's entertaining to me to scratch my noodle and say, why do you think he said it? Now, there may be other reasons. Maybe those reasons aren't valid. I can't tell you, but at least that's my thought.
I would say I'd be a little leery to say we know he said it because it's only found in Mark and Luke, which are two of the most removed of the eyewitness accounts.
Yeah,
so,
the fact that it's in both of them, though.
It indicated that he said it.
Yeah, and you know, Mark is basically a reaffirmation of Shimon Kefesh's presentation.
I'm just always leery of anything in the Greek. And
right,
those two in
particular. And, you know, when the disciples had the Jerusalem summit with he whose name should not be mentioned, they spoke of food sacrifice to idols. That bothered them because that would be emulating the religion of the Babylonians. So they had a reason to be concerned about the food sacrifice to idols because that's following in the footsteps of buying into the Gentile religion. And, you know, that's like eating the Easter ham, you know. So they said, you know, we don't want to go to that point, but they didn't put none of the other instructions in the Torah regarding food were mentioned. Now, that's a weak argument.
Well, now, can I mention some bloodbath in here saying, I understand it's not law, but it did set Israel apart everywhere they went. No, it really didn't. What ended up setting Israel apart was the fact that they weren't set apart. They picked up religion and started acting religious, dressing religious, emulating other religions. And then you could distinctly tell their religion from another.
Right.
That's what ended up setting Israel apart.
Well, that's brilliant. That's brilliant.
What they were supposed to do to
because
be set apart.
Is Israel right now set apart
from
Yahweh or set apart unto Yahweh? Right now, is Israel and Yehudah, are they, as we sit right now, are they set apart from Yahweh or are they set apart unto Yahweh?
By and large.
Yeah.
And that's
there'll
how
be a time
of their history.
Right.
We do have Lisa and a couple others that are not. You know, they're set apart to Yahweh. But for the most part, most Jews I know don't recognize the Torah. They don't know the Torah.
Correct.
They see it. They're still afflicting themselves on Kippurim. All of them I know.
And by the way, they're also, when they say they're Torah observant, they're Talmud observant. Yeah, they're Talmud observant. And they view the Talmud as the oral law.
Yes,
so they use Torah observant to speak of the Talmud as if it were oral law. And so when they say they're Torah observant, it means strictly that they're Talmud observant.
I know it. I know. Believe me. I had one I was talking about, Bikurim. And he's a good friend of mine. His name's Jakob. And he says, well, no, I only do the feasts that are in the Torah. And I showed him Bikurim right in the Torah. I said, what do you say to that? He goes, I'll have to consider that. I'll have to think about that. I had no idea of Bikurim. No idea. No idea of it. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
that's
all right.
One they just threw out the window.
Okay. Now, I do want to tell you that while we had a mess a week ago. I mean, it was an explosion, and everybody was pointing the fingers to who started it and who was bad and everything else. Apart from that, I got to tell you that this was really a positive and productive experience. Matter of fact, one of my favorite people, Richard, who has the Bless Yahweh site, he took what we did last week, where we went through every word again, and we did a thorough analysis of it, and we talked about the pronouns, and we looked really intently at it to try to resolve people's concerns by identifying what was said. That it was, in his view, one of the best shows we have done in a long time. He actually created a feature just on that because there is so much learning that comes out of it. And in context, it's really profound because the context is Moshe is saying, the instruction from Yahweh is to completely distance yourself from every aspect of that which is religious. And Dabbatim 12 begins with this whole long list of saying, don't do any of this religious stuff. And then it transitions into, I want you to pay a very close attention to and focus on the teachings, particularly as it relates to those in the choke, the instructions that are inscribed, that cut us into the relationship, and the mitzvot, which are the invitations to meet with God that resolve the disputes, with this one exception, this one exemption, and then it goes down through the food. I mean, gosh, I think it's brilliant. I think it's fascinating, and I think that most of us benefited from it. We grew from it. We enjoyed it, and so. Please don't ask me to do it again, however.
Yeah, you're the one that brought it up, by the way. I didn't, but I took a flogging from some people, but I don't even care. The truth of the matter is, I realize that the covenant is a very relaxed affair. We are not doing and obeying as hard as we can, as perfect as we can, because we can't. We can try to understand. Isn't the purposes of the seven Moed Mikra, aren't they for the purposes of understanding? Isn't that what the reading and the reciting is about? Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's for the purposes of understanding. And so what I've come to understand, and really just so much more, even in this last week because of this, and this is not a joke, uh-huh. I've come to understand that Yahweh is so opposed to religion, he doesn't even want us to listen to them.
Yeah.
He not even barely answer them. They're worthless to him because
right.
they don't get who he is and what it is he's trying to get across. Picture a creator who hates religion. Picture a creator who thinks more like an atheist than he does like a Christian.
Yeah.
Picture.
You know, why does Yahweh hate religion?
Well, they attach all kinds of nonsense to him. He's omnipresent. He's a goofball. He's like a Santa Claus on steroids.
In one way, he's the Easter Bunny, all loving, all soft and cuddly. But on the other side, he's sadistic and in saying you either
capitulate
to me or I'm going to torture you forever in hell. So he's
right.
So I think that that part of the reason that Yahweh hates religion is because religion miscasts him, and it miscasts him in horribly inappropriate ways. I don't think there's really any difference between renaming Yahweh, calling him the Lord, or calling him Allah, or whatever people want to call him, Hashem. I don't think there's any difference between changing his name and changing his identity. And all religion do both. They change his name and they change his nature. And
why do you think we're standing here talking to brick walls day after day?
Right.
Really?
The religious gods do not resemble Yahweh. Yahweh is the antithesis of a religious deity in the sense that he doesn't want to be worshipped. He doesn't want to intimidate. He doesn't... He's not omnipresent. He's not all-knowing. He doesn't die and get resurrected. He is not just masculine and not just feminine, but an incorporation of paternal and maternal aspects. He is extremely approachable. I mean, for the creator of the universe, he's downright humble. And... So I think that is the mischaracterization of Yahweh by both name and nature is one of the reasons that God hates religion. I agree with that.
There's one other thing I just want to throw in here. It's very important for us to understand that there was no physical resurrection. We came to that realization, a couple of years ago now?
Right. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And it came right out of the PSOC instructions. And then you look in Yashayahu where it's saying, you know, the whole prophecy about being numbered with and taking the strokes to the family. And what are you dealing with from the point of the crucifixion? All you're dealing with is Nepesh until he sees the light, the Kodesh, you know, the Ruach. And then they join back together. And then you recognize, nobody recognized him.
Right.
And, okay, now we get it. So one thing's for sure, and we went through this, and I'm not sure if it was on Shattering Myths or this show.
It also says, it explains, you know, why he told the women, don't touch me. I've not yet gone to the Father, because touching him as energy would have killed them. Wouldn't have hurt him, but it would have killed them. And it also explains walk through walls and yet be transformed into a physical being when he wished to be. It also explains how he ended up on the road to Emmaus, 60 stadia outside of Jerusalem, and then instantaneously end up with the disciples in the upper room transferring through the wall. So it explains everything.
Yeah, and it also, there is one other thing I want to add here. We went through this that a physical body would it be helpful,
liability.
In the next life, or would it's it
liability.
Be a liability? And we know it's a liability.
Right.
So everybody wants to get caught up on these physical things, and I guess they want to go have a good, proper burial. I'm going to be cremated, personally.
Personally, I don't care. In fact, I've told my wife, whatever it is you want to do, whatever makes you happy, you feel free to do.
It's just cheaper and less nonsense is the way I look at it.
Cremate me and do it, whatever's the cheapest way.
Right.
Just have a nice
well, that would be cremation.
The fact that you enjoyed my time here.
Yeah.
And I want her to go down and do what they did on the Big Lebowski. When they need a receptacle, just get a coffee can or whatever.
There you go. There you go.
I'm serious.
Bury me in a Pringles bottle.
But that, by the way, example is one of those that if you put all the pieces together and you start to think about it with an open mind, all of a sudden conflicts evaporate, and what you have is a consistent understanding and appreciation of the totality of what we know. Marvelous example, and it completely lampoons, of course, Easter and the Christian myth that their God died for their sins. And it completely destroys this concept of resurrection of the dead from the Christian promise. Okay, so what is the second reason that God hates religion? And I'm going to propose a second reason. I think it is because it provides false hope. And I think that false hope is one of the worst things you can possibly do. I think it is mean. It is hateful. It's despicable. Offering somebody false hope is a horrible thing.
False hope is worse than no hope.
That is correct.
It's delusional.
I think you give somebody false hope, and that is a horrible thing. You tell somebody that all they have to do is believe, and they're going to be saved, and they'll see their mother and father and children and everybody in heaven. You've given them false hope. That's me.
I literally had a woman tell me that this week. All you got to do is believe. So what's the argument here? That's what she said. I said, well, my problem with that is that it's a lie. I don't know what craziness you're talking about. I had no idea what craziness I'm talking about. You know, the Creator's words, that craziness.
Yeah, and matter
of fact,
just believe is the John 3:16 statement. And so Kirk and I, I hope Kirk can join me again on Monday, because it's going to take us a while to get through it, are trying to go through Yahu Kanan 3. You know, it's the discussion with Nicodemus that leads to that statement, and what I want to show is that that the statement is based upon appreciating the teaching that's represented from the Torah that leads to the information and understanding that is required to trust and rely, and that statement, out of context, is absolutely absurd and provides false hope. And so Kirk
I did a whole note on that. I did a whole note where I showed that that's just another quote taken out of context.
Right.
And it's
in
it's
context,
another one of those
man, you look at Yosha's presentation to Nicodemus and what he has to say. I mean, it is Torah-centric. It is set-apart spirit-centric. It is non-physical body resurrection-centric. It is brilliant in what he has to say, affirming the covenant, affirming the Torah, affirming the role of the set-apart spirit. It is about us not having physical bodies in eternity. It's brilliant. There's so much understanding that we can glean from Yahochanan 3 if we're diligent in our thought process. As a matter of fact, if our perspective is that the Torah is right, and you look at what Moshe said, yeah, from the Torah is right, everything that he says is affirming of the Torah and absolutely brilliant. And it almost gives you goosebumps to go through it. And, of course, all of that is dismissed except born again and John 3:16. And the rest of it, they just skip over.
Let's forget that if you're going to follow the path of Yahusha, you would have to be Torah observant, because he was Torah observant.
Right.
You can't say you believe in me and not do what I do. Well, he's not asking you to raise somebody from the dead or heal a leper. You can't do that. He's asking you to look at things from his perspective and take that walk. And, of course,
So the second reason that Yahweh hates religion is it provides false hope, and false hope is extremely mean. And religious profit by offering false hope. The third reason is because Yahweh went to great extent to conceive a plan that would resolve our sins, that would enable us to be adopted and live with him as his children, that he not only conceived, but articulated in great detail, and then himself engaged to walk the walk, to lead the way, to pay the price, to enable that plan. I mean, God is really vested in this plan. He conceived the plan. He articulated the plan. He himself enabled the plan. I mean, he is really invested in his plan. And every religion not only ignores his plan, but despises his plan. Now, how would you like to be God? You conceive the plan, you articulate the plan, you enable the plan, and every religion on earth either completely ignores your plan or actually is adverse to your plan, as is the religion of Christianity, as is the religion of Judaism.
Well, of course, this would totally, this would make your blood boil.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Gotta piss God off big time.
That's right. And you know, you sit there in the situation we're in. I mean, it's really bad because we know. You know, we're sitting here telling people, no, you got this wrong, you got this wrong, you got this wrong. And what do you got? You got the usual group out there saying, oh, I see a billion of us don't know what we're talking about. And I feel like, yeah, that's right.
That's right, that's right.
Because they set you in a little room and said, the B-I-B-L-E, yes, that's the book for me. And ever since you could think, this is all you've ever heard. And
yes,
because
Jesus
you're a person
this
that
I know,
believes
the
what
Bible
the authority
tells me
figures
so.
Told you, you're a dead walking zombie.
I mean it.
But,
right. Okay,
yeah,
now then there's a fourth reason. In my opinion, I think you've just hit it. By putting all of this religious rhetoric out there that is so obviously stupid, and but so syrupy sweet, what the religious have done has caused the preponderance of people to accept something as reliable when it is not, and therefore be opposed to investing the time and energy that it takes to know and understand what he has actually conveyed. So religion is a disincentive to know and understand. And
right,
in that
unless
regard,
you want to know, unless you want to make a recipe book, because they all the women can make little covered dishes every Sunday, and they can tell each other how kind they are, and how good the apple pie was, and that's that.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
and
the
how I love the Lord. I just love my Lord Jesus Christ.
I don't even know anything about him, but I love him, right? I mean, I remember going to church waiting to hear something about him.
Yeah.
And
no,
I never did.
Him.
I heard a lot about Paul. I heard a lot about how Paul was a really, man, he knew it all. He was a Pharisee's Pharisee, and he walked away from it for this right here. And I kept thinking, well, it's pretty empty in here.
Yeah. All right, so those are the reasons I think that Yahweh is so opposed to religion. I'm sure there are others, but it is the thing that that he hates so much that it was the first requirement of the covenant. Now, you might say, okay, there's five requirements of the covenant. How can you be so steadfast that there's five requirements of the covenant when you say that the rest of it's not rules or requirements? Well, there's a huge difference. And the huge difference is the covenant is out there for our choice. The covenant is out there for our option. And so it's one of those things where you say, all right, I want to be part of it, or I don't want to be part of it. If I want to be part of it, then Yahweh says, all right, for you to be part of it, that means that we're going to spend eternity together. And for us to spend eternity together, we better like each other. We better have the same perspective, the same likes and dislikes. Otherwise, spending eternity together is going to be really, really uncomfortable. And so here's a way to keep people who like religion from being really uncomfortable in heaven. And here's a way to keep those of us who don't like religion away from them in eternity. And so it is those requirements create an environment where eternity with Yahweh will be enjoyable for all parties, Yahweh included. And if he didn't
have...
Yeah,
we can thank Yahweh for that right now.
Right.
You know, I had a woman this week, and I know these anecdotes some people don't like to hear, but that's too bad. I had a woman say, and he died for you. You know, he was crucified for you. And I see you don't appreciate that. I said, I set Passover aside. What do?
Right. Yeah.
No answer. I said Passover aside.
Yeah.
What
by the way,
you do?
He didn't die for me. He didn't die for you.
Die.
He didn't die.
He didn't die. Period.
He didn't die. Period.
God cannot die.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's in Shabbat too, isn't it?
Is a God
yeah, it's
in
Shabbat. God, are you? Who are they kidding here? You can't die.
Laying it out there for
listen,
them. You know?
There are things God cannot do. You know, you and I, we can die. If we want to die, even if we don't want to die, we're going to die. God cannot die. Even if he wanted to die, he can't. So, no, God can't die. Oh, my. So, fellas and ladies, there's a lot of reason to dislike religion. And Yahweh is first among them, and he came up with conditions for participating in his covenant that thankfully eliminate the situation where we would be exposed to it for all eternity, because, God, I want to get away from it. You know, one last thing. Lurie, you mentioned something that I actually like, which you said that, you know, Yahweh thinks more like the agnostic than he does the Christian. And
no, I said atheist,
right.
But...
Yeah, I know, but I changed
but
it to agnostic.
Why appeal to me.
Sound a little smarter.
Yeah, well, that's probably a better way to put it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because the atheist has as much faith as does the Christian. The agnostic doesn't.
Yeah, he's gone full retard. I agree.
Right, the atheist has gone full retard. The agnostic has not. The agnostic
agnostic, by and large, just hasn't been exposed to good information.
Correct.
Usually when you meet an agnostic, if they're truly agnostic, you provide them the information. Yeah, they're going to come right along because the information makes sense.
Yes, correct. That's exactly right.
If they're
right.
not, they're really just right. an atheist who's claiming
and,
to be an agnostic.
Right, and what appeals to an agnostic is typically evidence and reason. And if you can use evidence and reason about what Yahweh had to tell us and how it is reasonable all the way through and it resolves the conflicts that exist with religion and the foolishness of religion, an agnostic is typically going to respond the way you did, J.B. And, you know, the first to respond to all of this was actually a Jewish physician, a good friend, a Jewish physician, and you know his response was, you know, I'm not Jewish religiously, I'm Jewish ethnically, and I was an agnostic because I did not like the practitioners of Judaism; they were repulsive to him, and so he says, but you know. This makes total and complete sense. And so for a highly educated, very bright man, it appealed to him. And the second happened to be the computer programmer, my very good friend in Virginia, was an agnostic, former, you know, raised to be a Roman Catholic, though he, too, is ethnically Jewish. And he says, you know, I rejected religion because it was stupid. He says, I became an atheist, and that was too much work, so I became an agnostic. You presented evidence and reason from Yahweh's testimony. It resonated. It made sense. And it's just, why would I want to argue with this? It's exactly as it should be. And powerful affirmations all the way through. And I would tell the agnostic that, you know, agnostics say that God is unknowable. And I would tell the agnostics, then, you've never considered Yahweh's prophecies. Yahweh's prophecies prove that he exists. His Torah makes him knowable. The argument that God is unknowable is completely mitigated by the Torah and prophecy. He proves his
That's
existence.
Right.
He wholly and completely identifies who he is and what he's like. So,
yeah,
all
but
of that,
I mean, to an insane point, his proof, right down to how Alexander died, right down to this being the last generation, and we're moving towards a one-world government, which we all see.
Right.
It scares
the
hell out of
us.
And
the catalyst is the United States malfeasance in Syria causing that war, and the consequence and aftermath of that war causing Israel to be thinned at the waist, and that ushering in this horrible time of Jacob's trouble, the tribulation. The specificity of that, the detail of that, and reading it, you know, seeing it before our eyes, I mean, it is so convincing that you really have to be wholly opposed to evidence and reason not to be convinced by it.
It's shockingly accurate. I think at the end of that, where you've got that whole thing broken down, don't you say it looks like you're reading tomorrow's newspaper?
Yeah.
And that's just what it looks like. Yeah. They run out of each other to kill, and finally they get around to the Jews in Israel. That's what happens, isn't it?
That's exactly what happens. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
they're going to be
out
at another
greater,
10 years, and they'll
yeah, they kill
run
each other
out of
in greater
other.
Syria, and then they ultimately destroy Syria, which is all that Muslims can do. They can't build anything; they just destroy. And then once they've completely destroyed Syria, and it falls, the government falls, they turn on Israel and flood into Israel by the hundreds of millions. Yeah, it's all there. Even with America, every detail. I mean, I once said, you know, it's like 12 or 13 attributes that define it as America, and that doesn't even come close. I mean, it's probably 100 attributes that define it as America that the warning is to, and who is the primary belligerent in Syria, providing the weapons, actually providing the impetus for it by invading Iraq and empowering Iran to create
and giving them the money. Giving them the money, arming them, this country that has a giant navy that runs around dragging everybody along with them.
Right.
I mean,
and are shining birds of prey with a recognition that almost all of our military aircraft are named after birds of prey. I mean, it goes on and on. The specificity is truly amazing, but, you know, you've got to be open to it. You've got to want to see it. You've got to do your due diligence and study it. It's there for
yeah, but when
the,
somebody
the
else has actually put that down for you and you plop it in front of somebody's face, it doesn't take a lot of effort, Yada.
Yeah,
I had a judge tell me this was all BS because it was written thousands of years ago.
Yeah, when in fact that's what makes it profound.
Well, yeah. That's why you wouldn't want to show up in this guy's courtroom. I mean,
yeah, after the fact testimony, telling us what happened for him is more relevant than somebody telling you what's going to happen.
And it does.
It does.
Exactly. Yep.
And it does. All right. Psalm 119, 163. I genuinely hate, shun, and I'm totally hostile to deceptive beliefs. And I choose to consistently despise, continually degrading and disparaging them. I totally and genuinely love your Torah. All right, so for anybody that thinks that for one moment that Yahweh isn't anti-religion, Dode, who was clearly inspired by Yahweh, we know he was inspired by Yahweh for a number of reasons. Okay, JB, you're quiet there for a moment. Why do we know for certain that Dode was inspired, David was inspired by Yahweh?
Well, he was called the man after God's own heart.
Yep, there you go.
That's pretty good evidence.
Right,
you know,
did Yahweh say
prophecy?
He's righteous? Right. Did Yahweh mention his name in the prophets?
Several times.
Yeah, in fact, he called it probably 50 times. And he's always talking about his love for him and the fact that he's going to reestablish Dode's kingdom when he returns. So do you think that God would speak about a guy that made it all up, that it wasn't really inspired but just pretended to be inspired, if in fact he says all these wonderful things about Dode?
I'm going to model my kingdom after this guy over here. You know, he's a liar, but I'm going to model my kingdom after him.
Yeah. So
don't listen to what he said.
So God would be an absolute idiot.
It's like common sense to me.
Right. Okay. So it's common sense based upon that. There's a second reason that we know for fact that Dode's Psalms are inspired. What is the second way we know?
Yeah, prophecy.
There you go, prophecy. His prophecies aren't just vivid. They are like over the top.
Like describing a crucifixion to the T. Stuff like that.
Literally more accurate than the eyewitness accounts.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, his depiction of crucifixion is consistent with what we learned about 50 years ago with modern forensics. I mean, you know, it talks about great detail of the method.
You can read in depth with a scientific description of how what the body goes through during a crucifixion.
Right.
Stretching ligaments out.
Right. Yeah, dying of thirst
sure
while you're grounding.
Modern doctors plagiarized that.
Yeah. So we know from prophecy that he was inspired. Now, there's a third reason that is consistent with the test that Yahweh provided. It's a bit more subtle. And that is, if Yahweh, if we want to know whether or not Yahweh inspired somebody.
It never contradicts the Torah.
There you go. You look at it. Something that Yahweh has said is it consistent with what Yahweh has said. Everything Dode writes is consistent with Yahweh's nature. So when Dode says, I genuinely hate, shun, and I'm truly hostile to deceptive beliefs, and I choose to completely despise, continually, and denigrate them, under that basis, he is therefore reflecting Yahweh's desire for us. He wants us to hate, shun, and be wholly hostile to deceptive beliefs, misleading statements, lies, and vanity, all that is false, fraudulent, and unreliable. That's what he wants.
I'm hostile towards them. Hostile.
Yep.
Most of the people that I've shared Yahweh's words with, they are hostile to people in the same manner I am.
Yeah, that's right.
I've seen it. I've read the posts.
Yeah.
And there's no need to be nice about it. We're not here to make a compromise.
You know, when I first wrote Prophet of Doom and Tea with Terrorists, I was told that, you know, you should reflect Jesus's nature and be accommodating and technical. You should judge not lest you be judged. You're way too judgmental here. You're too vindictive. You're too hateful. And that is not the approach.
And you told him you would have, but you don't have a cat of nine tails and a table to turn over, right?
And my response was, you know, the God I know is judgmental. The God that I know is hostile to lies. You know, the God I know is the God that that in Matignon 23 went on for 20 minutes on how much he hates religious people. So, no, this reflects Yahweh's nature. Absolutely. I shun, I'm totally hostile to, I hate deceptive beliefs, misleading statements, lies, and vanity. And for all the reasons we mentioned 30 minutes ago, he hates them. He disparages them. He chooses to consistently and continually disparage them. All right. The single most effective way to recognize a lie, the single greatest motivation for despising the lie is what? If I were to tell you, I'm going to provide you with something that will help you in all cases understand who is lying and will cause you in all cases to hate the lie, what would I have to give you?
The Torah.
There you go. Right. Love of the Torah, appreciation of the Torah, is what causes both of these reactions. It's what causes you to recognize what is untrue, and it causes you to hate what is untrue, and it causes you to act and expose and condemn, to degrade that which is untrue. Now, why does the Torah cause you to do all of those things? And love of the Torah. Why would the love of the Torah cause you to hate the lie and to act aggressively?
Well, because you understand how important it is.
You know what they're giving up. You know what they're, you know, what the opportunity is. You know what the deception is.
Yep.
It makes everything clear.
Right.
You're talking about freedom and wealth. Freedom and wealth beyond, you know, that's why when Yahweh's talking to these poor, dumb religious bastards, he's telling them, you know, you say you're rich, and I say you're poor and naked. They're naked because the ruach's not on them.
Right.
Right. I mean, they're not clothed in that white, shiny coat of light. And those people are wealthy that are. And they're part owners of the universe. You know, that's a, you know, you said that very easily, you know, when you brought that up. You know, it's a concept I never really thought of, to be honest with you. But when you're adopted into the royal family, you're an owner.
You're an owner.
That's a big deal.
You're an inheritor of the universe. You're royalty.
Right. Dode's looking at the benefits. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
So yeah,
as a matter of fact,
is
the kingdom of Dode, is the kingdom of Dode any different than the kingdom of Yahweh?
No.
Isn't the whole idea of the kingdom of Yahweh is that we inherit the universe because we're adopted into his family based upon his Torah teaching? Isn't that why Yahweh is emphasizing the kingdom of Dode? Because that is what he's offering. That's what he wants. That's the whole purpose.
Yeah, and that's what Dode talks about.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's the offer, man. It's
a
royal offer.
JB, you hit the nail on the head. The reason that we recognize that there are lies is that the Torah's presentation of who Yahweh is, what he wants, what he expects, and what the benefits are is wholly and totally and irreconcilably different than every religion. So that's the first thing. God said this, the religious say that. They are in conflict. The conflicts cannot be resolved. So since they all claim to represent this God, even the Quran claims to represent the instructions in the Torah, and since they all are in wholesale conflict with them, they have to be wrong. There is no chance whatsoever that any religion is right because they claim to affirm the Torah when in fact they're in wholesale conflict with it. So you know that they're lying. That's the first part. The second part is, once you come to know Yahweh as he is in the Torah, I mean, he's really lovable. He's likable. He's fun. He's somebody you want to approach and want to be around. And so you want to share the actual nature of Yahweh because he's one cool dude. Next, Yahweh's plan, this plan that he conceived to resolve our differences and to enrich us and empower us, I mean, it's the deal of the universe. It's the best deal that's ever been conceived. Even the requirements for us to participate are benefits for us. I mean, we come out so slick in this deal. We just get every possible benefit. And so you want to share that. I mean, this is the deal of the, not of the century, of the millennia, of all time. And so you're motivated to want to share it. And then you become angry. Because here God has come up with this wonderful plan that's so beneficial to us. And he has articulated it and gone into such great extent to etch what he had to say in stone, if you will. And then he himself enabled it. And you realize that all of these religious morons are claiming that they are providing salvation for those who will listen to them when they, in fact, are depriving people of all of this benefit. And they're doing so.
You know, a lot of this, too,
contradicting
a lot of this goes to the fact that many people that we, and by we, I mean all of us, you know, in the chat room and participating and listening to the show and observe the Torah, people we love. That don't listen, they've deprived themselves out of life. And I think it's almost all a direct result of religion.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
Honestly believe that.
Yeah. So
people we know and
so
care about.
These concepts are related. Love of the Torah and genuine hate for that which misleads. They are directly related. By the way, is it possible to judge not, lest you be judged, and genuinely hate
God
and be totally hostile to?
No.
No.
But that's another thing that the religious God does. Check your brain at the door.
Oh, of course.
Check your brain at the door.
So this is a powerful statement. It's one of my very favorite. And I want to make one last comment before we move on. And that is that I came to the conclusion in trying to understand who Yahweh is and understand what he said that to love requires hate. You cannot love unless you can also hate. And love and hate work together. That if you genuinely love your children, you will hate those who wish to harm them. And you're not loving if you don't hate that which is harmful to others. Love and hate go hand in hand. Hate is required for genuine love. And this passage, this statement from Dod in this psalm affirms one of the most profound and important truths that we can possibly convey. You know, there are a lot of people that dismiss the Torah because they say that's that wrathful God that is so mean and spirited. Yeah, he is
full of laws.
You know, but they're partially right.
Sometimes he is mean spirited.
That is right. There are times where he's flat out mean, where he is wrathful. But
yeah, when he sent the Yehudi into the Promised Land and told them kill everyone, leave
right.
No one left.
Right.
That was. You know, you would call that mean, but it was loving. It was mean
Absolutely.
To those people, but it was loving to his children.
Right. Absolutely. Because otherwise, his children would move into a home that was infected with the most contagious and deadly disease this planet has ever seen, religion.
It's a hard thing to it's hard for me to understand why people can't get around that when you point it out to them. It'd be like saying, "Hey, welcome the crack whores and the crack house to your neighborhood."
Right.
Which of us would do that?
Yeah, because we're not supposed to kill. Let's make certain that we invite rats that are contaminated with the bubonic plague into our home, and then let's have our children play with them. Okay, that'll work out well, won't it?
That's right.
And that is
sure. And that's exactly what he was talking about. And that's exactly what's happened to the societies of all the lost tribes.
Right. And that's why he says, we're not going to eliminate them until their iniquity is full. When they reach a point where there is no hope for them, where they're so corrupt by religion that there is no longer any hope for any of them, then there's nothing lost by shortening their lives, and everything to gain by ridding my home for my children of the most infectious, the most contagious, the most debilitating, the most deadly disease ever to infect this planet, religion.
What's the biggest, I'm going to tell you what I think. The biggest religion on the planet, this is what I think, is political correctness. That's what I believe.
Yeah, it is today.
Oh, yeah.
It is. It's really close. But there are probably 1.5 million Catholics, but all of those Catholics aren't Christians. Many of them are more politically correct than they are Catholic. And but if you look at China, the largest population on Earth, the vast majority of the Chinese would be socialist secular humanists, therefore political correctness, if you will, is the moral code for that. It's the largest segment now of Americans and Canadians, and it's the largest segment of Europeans. So if you look at Americans, Europeans, and Chinese, as well as non-religious Indians, it's right there at the same 2 billion mark. If you discount Christendom a little for those who the labels applied to that really aren't, you'd have about 2 billion. I think there's about 2 billion socialist secular humanists whose moral code would be political correctness. There's probably a billion.
And then you have political correctness woven into Christianity, too. You really do.
Oh, of course.
You really do.
Absolutely, yeah. And politics that are woven into it. But, yeah, that would all be true. That's why I make it a point on Shattering Myths to constantly include socialist secular humanism in the dogmas that are advanced by humankind that are debilitating.
It is. One of them.
Yep.
It's as religious as Christianity or Islam.
That is true. America and so has Europe have incorporated a national religion. Socialist secular humanism and its moral code political correctness. Politically, militarily, even industrially, and in the media, there is the pervasiveness of political correctness. And anyone that steps outside of the reins of political correctness and says or does anything that is considered politically incorrect is crucified. It's the religion of America, and we've established it because we're unaware that such dogmas have the same effect as religion. All right, this next statement, 164, is an affirmation of something that you really have to have an appreciation of, I think, to know Yahweh or appreciate his plan. It is sevenfold way of affirmation. Sevenfold by way of affirmation, maybe I should say. I radiate your light. So sevenfold by way of affirmation, during the day I radiate your light according to your righteousness and vindicating means to achieve justice and resolve disputes. The word is either Sheba or Shaba. They would both be written the same way. There'd be no distinction between them. One of those vocalizations is seven. The other one is affirmation, vow, promise. Okay? So those are you've got two options. Sevenfold, seven, and vow, promise, affirmation. So what Dode is doing here, he's talking about radiating Yahweh's light, which is halal, and he's attributing that to a plan and an affirmation of the plan that involves a promise pertaining to the number seven. Now, do you guys know of a plan that Yahweh affirmed that pertains to the number seven that would lead to us radiating his light?
I can think of one.
Yeah.
What? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Now, do we have to
there's
actually...
There's seven of those.
Yeah, do we actually have to think this through? I mean folks, we're all laughing, but...
I'm laughing because I know what the normal translation is. Seven times a day I pray.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Why do they just make this stuff up? Why do they do
right.
this? I don't understand.
The word is either Sheba or Shaba. There is no times here. There is no reference to times. It is either seven or oath or promise. Okay? So you've got to, if you want to deal with the word... You can't change the word because you want to make a religious edict out of it. The word is either Sheba or Shaba. One means seven, the other means promise. A promise is an affirmation. It is in fact, let me just give you every word in Hebrew. I'll give you every potential definition of S-H-B-A in Hebrew. Seven, sevenfold, by way of affirmation, as a benefit, an abundant promise, something that is based upon a vow or a sworn oath. Now, I have 20 lexicons and dictionaries. I've gone through every single one of them. I've looked at every related word. That's it. Okay? Benefit, abundant promise.
That's not a lot of choice.
Seven, vow, sworn oath. Affirmation, sevenfold. That's what you got to work with. Okay? With that, when you have to work with, are you going to say, woe is me, I can't figure this out? Or are you going to say, wait a minute, he's talking about halal, which is to radiate light. I am completely transformed by being enlightened and empowered, to radiate light, to be empowered, to be enlightened. And you say, okay, is there a promise that involves the number seven that leads to that? Let's see. Passover is the first step.
Let's use our imaginations just a little bit.
Yeah, Passover is the first step. It is the doorway to God's home and to being receiving the benefits of the covenant. It's the doorway to life. And by the way, enlightened means that you are now equated to light, which means you are eternal. Passover is the doorway to eternity because it is the doorway to eternal life. The second step along the way is matzah, which makes us perfect. Isn't light perfect? Perfect form of energy. Where there is light, there is no darkness. So light is what makes us appear perfect because there can be no darkness where there is light. The third aspect is we are adopted into Yahweh's family as his children. Aren't we going to convey his attributes? I mean... JB, you have not had this experience yet, but Larry, you and I have. We've had children. Our children reflect some of our nature. They look like us. Yahweh is his spiritual entity. When we are adopted into his family, don't you think we might just reflect some of his nature? So
we would hope so, wouldn't we?
So Bekodim leads to us being adopted into his family and conveying some of his attributes. And the fourth Moed Mikre has also been fulfilled. And the fourth Moed Mikre causes us to be enriched and empowered. There you go. Now, there are three more steps beyond that that have yet to be fulfilled in time from our perspective, from Yahweh's perspective, already been fulfilled. The fifth is Teruah, where we convey the truth. We convey Yahweh's message. We become his troubadours. And the Sixth is that we are reconciled, particularly Yisrael and Yehudim, but we're reconciled in our relationship with Yahweh, and we become Yisrael and we become Yahudah when we understand what those words mean. You know, Yisrael is individuals who engage and endure with God, and Yahudah means related to Yah and relates to Yah. So, you know, we become those things. And the finally, you want to talk about understanding the sevenfold way and reflecting Yahweh's light. You know, try camping out with God for all eternity, which is Sukkah, the seven of those seven steps. That's about as enlightening, as empowering, as radiant as you're ever going to get. Now, he goes on to say, this is in accordance with your righteous and your righteousness and vindication, and your means to achieve justice and resolve disputes. Mitzvah preceded by tzedek. So all means according to. So now we've got the sevenfold promise. The sevenfold promise is what makes us righteous. Is there anything that Yahweh says in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms that makes us righteous other than his seven-step path, particularly the second of the seven steps, matzah? Is there any other place, makes us righteous?
No. I mean, you do have to be, you know, circumcised, but other than that, no.
Well,
I mean,
the terms and conditions of the covenant include our walking to God to become perfect, to be tzedek.
And that's done by walking down that path.
The third requirement of the covenant. The first covenant is to walk away from religion and politics, walk away from your country, from the family of man. The second is to trust and rely on Yahweh. The third is to walk to Yahweh and to become perfect. So the terms and conditions of the covenant actually assume that we participate in his mitzvot, which is the only means to walk to and become perfect. So circumcision, which is the fifth requirement of the covenant, the fourth, of course, is to be observant, to observe the terms and conditions of the covenant, to carefully consider them. The fifth, which is to be as a man circumcised. The reason is that And the reason that Yahweh says you can't participate in Passover, you can't engage in the covenant, and you can't enter heaven if you're a man and you're uncircumcised, is because if you aren't a member of the covenant and you observe Passover, that's deadly. I mean, that's not deadly. It's the worst of all possible options. That's a horrible thing for
you. Yeah,
you
become eternally separated, so you wouldn't. Yeah, it would be
right.
A horrible decision.
It's a horrible fate. A horrible fate. So Yahweh doesn't want somebody who hasn't signed, who isn't signed into the covenant via the sign of the covenant, which is circumcision, participating in Passover, because they would be eternally separated from him. So that's the reason for that. This statement here tickles my fancy, and it does so because, and I've said this so many times, that I know that my definition of misfot is inconsistent with your religious publications and Bibles. I came to see misfot as I came across it hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times in Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms as a word that is, it is almost always conveyed judgments. And so I said, okay, how does Yahweh judge? What is Yahweh's means of remaining just? Because and then I looked at all the connotations of the word, and it speaks of resolving disputes while remaining just and exercising good judgment. And I said, well, Yahweh has a plan to resolve disputes while exercising good judgment. So if we exercise good judgment and take advantage of his means for him to remain just while resolving the disputes that would separate us, that there are seven of those They're the invitations to meet with God. And it seemed like this was a perfect fit. And so I began to translate it that way. And then you see it in context here where he associates Tzedakah with it. Well, there's only one way to be vindicated, and that's to attend these invitations to meet with God. And so when you see vindication associated with Mitzvot, then you recognize that it has to be the means to achieve justice and resolve disputes. There is no other way about it. You know, if you were to render it to judgments, if you're being judged by Yahweh and you haven't availed of a way to be perfected, you haven't walked to him along the path he's provided to be perfected. So you're being judged by God and you haven't taken advantage of that. Is there any chance?
You're going to lose.
You're
going
to lose
that.
Right? 100% of the
right.
time, in every possible way, you're going to lose. There is no set of circumstances where you're going to be vindicated if you're being judged by God.
Can I bring something up here? I think that's one of the reasons, you know, I mean, we see all the, you know, bring two doves or bring a dove and a pigeon or this or that for every little thing, okay?
Right.
You know, why you're acting it out so we can observe it and see it. And, you know, we understand, okay, this is the Ruach, you know, we get that. I think that he was hoping, well, not hoping, he'd already seen what would happen. But you would think people would be relieved that they no longer had all these sacrifices to give because, after all, he was giving the perfect sacrifice. What do you think of that? There was all these things, these little things here and there and this day and that day to do. But yet, once he laid out the perfect sacrifice, he did it.
Right.
And if you were trying, especially you or me today, mm-hmm. or anyone listening, trying right. to meet him on that plane of judgment because we had acted
right.
out perfectly
right.
all these
right.
things,
right.
we would fail miserably,
right.
all of us.
Yeah, I
so
think
it has
a profound
be.
Statement. It's why I don't, when I have lamb at Passover, I don't think of the lamb accepting my sin and causing me to be immortal in the sense of that lamb that I'm eating. I don't sprinkle the blood of that lamb on my doorpost because I get the lamb without its blood. It's drained in the butchering process. I recognize that what that lamb is symbolic of, it pointed to and now affirms what Yahweh did for us on Pesach. And so it's not my job to do these things. It's my job to understand these things and then to capitalize on them, to respond. So I agree. There is no reason to bring a pigeon dove to Yahweh when Yahweh has already done everything that was required. And all the pigeon dove did is symbolize the role of the Spirit and the role of Yahweh, because the Spirit is part of Yahweh, just as is the Yahusha, the role that Yahweh played in our salvation. The pigeon dove points to that, the role of the set-apart Spirit in all of this. The lamb points to it, the role of Yahusha in all of this. So these were things that were symbols before he actually enabled it in the ordinary flow of time to help people understand what would happen. And now as we look back, to help us appreciate how these symbols all pointed to this reality.
Yeah, and it's pretty, again, that as you've said before, it's pretty easy for us now to see that. And,
yeah.
and hopefully it would have been pretty easy for them to see it, although apparently most didn't.
Yeah.
They
yeah, I'm gonna. You know, this is one of the things that I've said a long time because I have, so many people say, you know, well, if I had been there with the children of Israel and they and I'd seen the pillar of fire and I'd heard Yahweh's voice, you know, then things would be different, you know. And I say, you know, I'm here to tell you, and again, this is my opinion. I'm not trying to force
different.
This on anybody, but I think we are in the ideal point in time to know Yahweh and appreciate who he is and what he's offering. I don't think there's ever been a better time.
Yeah, we have more at our fingertips than most
right.
people had. You know, if they had all the money in the world throughout history, they wouldn't have as much as we have at our fingertips today.
That is correct. The richest scholar, the most with the largest library, would not have had access to even one in a hundred.
We have more at our fingertips than John Wycliffe had.
Oh, by
a hundred.
By tons and tons and tons and chasms, absolutely. We're in a wonderful position where if you want to know, you can know. And the one thing that, you know, I get all the time is, well, I don't have the time to learn Hebrew, and you know, simplify it for me. And you're just way too intense on this Hebrew thing and this Torah stuff, and God would never have made it that hard. And what about all the people that lived that didn't have access to all of them? You know, a loving God would never have condemned all of them. Well, it's true. A loving God would not have condemned them. They didn't know Him. He doesn't know them. He has nothing to do with them. My response is always the same. So what you're trying to do is create an excuse for you not investing the time, because you've got no excuse now. It's all available to you. It's all right here. It's just a matter of desire in your case. So what you're trying to do is make a case for you shouldn't have to do anything because they couldn't. You know? It's all available. And the other point that I make is, so why do you think this is the sacrifice? Why do you think that learning Hebrew is somehow a burden? Why are you...
We're coming to know God.
Why are you of
coming
the opinion...
Coming to know on a personal basis the creator of the universe. That's a sacrifice?
Right. You have the opportunity to get to know the creator of the universe and to introduce your family to the creator of the universe, and you would prefer to what? Go on a vacation someplace? Prefer to play a round of golf? Prefer to play a video game? You know, there's other things you do with your time. You'd prefer to indulge yourself with some other distraction rather than invest the time to get to know the creator of the universe. And, oh, by the way, you're presupposing that the time you spent observing the Torah, closely examining, carefully considering it, is less enjoyable than going out bowling.
Well, when you're finding...
It does require an engagement of the brain that most of the modern distractions don't require. But, again, to me, it's an investment. It's taking your time and investing it into something that will, you know, give you a millionfold what you put into it. Yeah, I'm going to admit, I'm the first who's guilty. I have plenty of times where I do something completely inane when I could be doing something much more beneficial.
Oh, we all do. We all do, but we're still... We still don't neglect the time of study and of thoughtful contemplation, because it not only brings us the most pleasure, it's the most enjoyable thing that we do, but it also is the one thing that we do that has eternal, everlasting merit, not only for ourselves, but for those we love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Invest a half hour a day. You know, find a half hour during your day where you can sit down and actually just delve into God's Word.
Or,
you know, if you ain't got a half hour, make it 15 minutes. I guarantee you, whatever amount of time you pick to choose, you know, start with 5 minutes. Whatever amount, it's not going to be enough for you once you get into it.
Or just try. How about this? How about devote an hour and a half to getting to know Yahweh on the Shabbat?
Yeah. I've tried to get several people to do that. People who want, you know, I hand them like yada yada, and they're like, oh, that's too long. I don't have time to read. I'm like, all right, well, here's a radio show. Tune into this. It's an hour and a half. You ain't got an hour and a half on a Friday night? Put it on.
Right, look, I've had people tell me, yeah, they've read that stuff.
They've read that stuff.
What'd they do, read two pages?
Yeah,
right. Yada yada.
A paragraph
read
that, oh, no, this is...
Well, what they say is I've read Craig's stuff. I've read his stuff. I don't know what to say to people like that. I mean, you know, they're obviously a lot brighter than I am. They just blow right through that stuff.
Yeah.
I actually had to study it.
I didn't know I had any stuff.
I didn't either.
You know, if you read yada yada, it's Yahweh stuff. If you read Intro to God, it's Yahweh stuff. And if you read Questioning Paul, it compares Yahweh stuff to Paul's stuff.
Paul's stuff.
But I didn't require. I didn't know I had any stuff in there. I don't even think I've got a decent opinion in a lot of it.
I think you have some very good opinions.
Most of it's just commentary on the translation and why you chose the way you chose.
Oh, yeah, that's not an opinion.
You make an opinion here and there, and you make it known.
Simply expresses the thought process and the options, because I want to engage the reader in the thought process. I want the reader to, you know, I love it when you have full disclosure. Somebody saying, you know, I'm not claiming I'm right here. I'm going to tell you, here are the options, and this is how I process this information and why I came to these conclusions based upon the information and making these connections. And so you have full disclosure here. You know,
you're writing down what's going through your head as you're doing the translations. When you come across a word, you look at the word, you're like, okay, it has this definition, it's in this stem, it has this tense, okay, how would I translate it here? You're just putting all that into words. Rather than just giving them a translation, you're saying, okay, here's the translation, here's how I came up with it.
Right. You know, here's what this particular stem conveys, the Peel stem, you know, where the object is influenced by the subject. You know, that's what this means. And what does the cohortative mood convey? Well, it's volition. So that happens to be first-person volition. So it has to be the speaker is expressing either a desire or a choice. You know, so you just walk through it and say, you know, this is written in the imperfect, which means this is ongoing. This is habitual. This is continual. So, you know.
Now, one thing you do is you occasionally draw, you know, connections that, you know, because you have a larger knowledge base than I do, you draw connections that I wouldn't get. So you'll connect something in, you know, Exodus to something in, you know, Isaiah. And, yeah, I wouldn't have got that because I don't have that knowledge base. But once I see it, it's like, oh, yes, this connects perfectly.
And I wouldn't say that in my case it's a knowledge base. It's just that it's the only thing that I have ever felt was that I was good at. You know, I'm not great at it. It's just that I have an affinity for making connections. I just love the Hebrew word.
You're better at it than I am.
Which is bien, which is means to make connections. I love making connections. I don't see things as random. I've always understood and appreciated the connections.
I don't think Yahweh writes random either.
No.
And you know the phrase the passage in Zechariah, and I'm just going to loosely say it, where they've been burned and blinded by the sun. You know, obviously Baal's, you know, Satan's favorite images are all the sun images, the holy and the halo and church and the cross and the light and all this nonsense. Well, you know, I posted that under the whole thing.
Christmas and Easter are also sun related.
As we know, that's the whole point here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so this woman jumps in and says, "You've got no scripture backing any of this up." And I put that scripture under the post, which was about all the sun images we find in Christianity and this and that and the other thing. She was so dense that she couldn't understand, hey, dummy, check it out, the sun's in constellation with Taurus the bull on Easter.
Right.
Get this, they're burned and blinded by the sun. He's returning after the sun goes down, stupid.
I've got to go, but Larry, the 100% of the insights that are provided in Yada Yada and Intro to God that, you know, aren't common elsewhere. For example, that there are three destinations.
They're thought out.
And why.
They're thought out, so it's
right.
not
what,
common.
Yeah, what's the
That's
purpose
right.
of Passover, of Matzah, Bukurim? I mean, there's a lot of things, the maternal nature of the set-apart spirit. There's several hundred things that are fairly unique to it, to these this study of Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms, that there isn't a single one of them that isn't anything but the residue of being observant. It's simply looking at what God said, thinking about what He said, and making connections. 100% of it is making connections. Like, why did Yahweh choose a feminine noun to convey the work and the nature of the set-apart spirit, the Ruach Kodesh. Why did he choose a feminine noun, and why did he always refer to in the feminine? And then why does he tell us to approach, to answer the invitation and approach the feminine nature of his light in the Moed Mikre? You know, you just make the connections, right?
Yeah, or honor thy mother and father,
right.
Which, of course, is
right after he has said
then,
that fathers mislead their children to the fourth and fifth generation, or third and fourth generation, whatever it is. Okay, you've got to be thoughtful. And that means you just take a moment and say, why is this? And, you know, why is it important, for example, that we found Devarim 12:15? Because now it explains that what Yosha said was consistent with the Torah. I mean, you make that connection. That connection's important. That the connection is the basis of understanding, and it is the source of most all meaningful insights.
Yeah, connections. I agree.
Right.
It's one connection to the next. I mean, the whole thing is he's loving it that we're making connections.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the reason that it's infinite and it could go on for 10 more lifetimes is he complicates it for that reason. There's people that have a more vast knowledge base like yourself, and then there's people like me.
No,
and,
I don't.
And
that's the thing I want to keep on emphasizing. I don't have a vast knowledge base. I really don't.
Whatever. You.
No.
Okay.
I only have one. Well, I share what we all share: a passion, an enthusiasm for knowing.
That's the biggest thing I got going for me.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. You have that. I have that. JB. We all, everyone listening, and now we're in the and just simply the archives now because the program's long over, but. We all have we share that passion for knowing Yahweh and knowing what he said. And that's the thing, the primary thing we all have going for us. And then the only thing that I have that is somewhat special, is this absolute love for and affinity for making connections. And so to some degree that has helped all of us. And then most of the time, if somebody will make the connection for you and demonstrate why that connection is valid and what it means, it brings a huge, big smile. And I think that we have all been the beneficiary of those connections. And that's
But that's
really
a rather
it.
Large verse, isn't it? Is that not a pretty large – that's quite a statement. They've been blinded and burned
right.
by the sun.
Right.
Well, once you realize this is happening,
right.
you look at it.
Right.
It's happening at twilight there,
right.
you know.
Right.
At
you make the connection. He's not talking about the big orb in the sky, is he?
That's right.
He's talking about religion, which is all based on sun imagery.
Sun worship and moon worship and all this
right.
nonsense.
The Babylonian
That's
religion
exactly.
and the Christian religion are very sun-centric.
I think that the reason that he really does point out the sun problem and really hates it, obviously, the only thing he might talk about even worse is the rabbis because they twisted his nature.
It is. Sun worship is so ingrained in Roman Catholicism, which is, according to Yahweh,
I think it took a lot of the lost mm-hmm. tribes away. That's what
yeah,
I think.
Think so.
That's what
oh,
I think.
Think. So that's why the altars on the top of the hill and the trees that that he talked about, the worshipful places in the trees, and all of these
and
kinds of things are all sun worship. I mean, obelisks and steeples in churches, all sun worship. It's Christmas, Easter, Sunday, the Lord, all of it.
The cross,
Babylon,
halos.
All of it, sun worship. Yes.
Yeah, and yet you and I see this so clearly.
Yes.
The three of us see this as...
Yes.
As clear as black and white.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can put it in front of a believer, and they don't get an ounce
right.
of it. They just
yeah.
become
But in fact, I
ballistic.
Can even extrapolate this to Islam. Islam is the crescent moon. Why? Read what Yahweh right. says about the greater and lesser light in the yep. fourth day of creation. Who is Allah? He's Satan. He is the lesser light. What is the moon? It's the lesser light. It reflects the sun's light in a diminished way. Still a light, but reflecting a diminished light. And so it identifies why Islam chose the crescent moon. And you can, these things are fun to make the connections, to understand. And we're all doing
it. To share.
Yeah, they're fun to share, and we're all
it's
doing
great
it.
When you share something like that and someone's eyes open for the first time.
Yeah.
Yet the more you know, and the more you share,
yep,
the less respect you have for people as you do it.
That's correct. You do. That's right. You do.
It's just getting. It,
you do.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, the masses. It's, you know, it doesn't preclude you from doing it. We still do it because, we want to leave people without excuse. That's the Yahweh wants people to know, so they're making an informed decision, and leaving people without excuse is a big deal to Yahweh. It's a big deal to him. And so we are leaving people without excuse. That's a very worthwhile thing to do. And number two, there is, you know, 1 in 100 or so that hear what Yahweh has to say that respond to him. And I know that it's 1 in 1 million that embrace the covenant, but it's not 1 in 1 million of the people who are willing to listen to what we're sharing about Yahweh. It's probably 1 in 100 of them. And
you pick a lot of people's interest, but you don't always get them to, you know, they don't always come along at the end, but I think you're right. About 1 in 100, you pique their interest. You get them enough to where they start questioning.
Yeah, my guess is there's over 1,000 people who from the various sites and the various individuals who have shared what we have come to know. That is probably 1,000 people that are part of the covenant today that wouldn't otherwise have been.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, that's a big deal. That's a big
deal.
It
is a big deal.
If it were three, it would be a big deal. Just the three of us, it would be a big deal.
I know. That's what I've always thought. Just a couple. Yeah.
In fact, I want to tell you, if it were just me, I'm sorry about you guys, but if it were just me, it would be a big deal and worth it.
As far as from where you're coming from,
if it were just me and my son, it would be a big deal. But the fact that it's 1,000 people that just makes it a bigger deal. It's exciting. It's thrilling.
There's a lot of bumps on the
right
road.
You know, and the difference too
you get
is
burned
that,
out
right is you that know? Yahweh's offer is the only offer that I'm aware of that the more people who inherit what he is offering, the richer we all become.
The inheritance for everyone becomes greater.
Right. Yeah, the
inheritance
for all of us actually increases if there's more of us.
Well, that's all true.
Marvelous.
I had this same woman tell me, why aren't you out on the street? Everybody on FB knows all this. I thought, wow, millions of people on FB,
and
they all know this.
Everybody on Facebook knows all of
this. They all just know this. So I should take Yahweh's words where there's a forum that's set up exactly for words and not use them on that forum. That's what she was saying. And that's what I told her. I said, she started the whole thing when I wasn't around on one of my posts, and she was telling everybody, this guy, you're worshiping him, you're following him. These are all people we know, and they're all going, we don't worship him. He shares words. You might want to read those words, blah, blah, blah. You know, they all said the same thing. I jumped in. I said, I'm not a leader of anything, and I have no followers, and I'm in the engine business myself. You know, and
I beg you, stop. And
then she tried to call me brother, and I said, we aren't related, idiot, you know, blocked her. Brother. Wow.
Yeah.
Attack.
If anyone's trying to follow me, please stop. I don't want that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Make accusations like that of people and then say, brother. What, how is that for hypocritical? How do you like that one?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Typical.
Well, guys, I've got to go. I'm in the process of packing up for a moving and getting the house prepared out here to sell. I'm working 17-hour
days
trying
to
get this done. It's not sold, but we changed realtors. We're representing the house, and they're restaging it. And I'm moving out, packing and moving out about 300 boxes.
Your wife.
Yeah, 300 boxes.
Well, JB and me might want to get together and buy the home. What are you asking for it?
don't put me in that spot. I will tell you about 2.5 million less than we have in it.
You'd have to pay me to do
that. Yeah, about 2.5 million less than we have in it. And anyway, so I'm here.
Is this the water house with the water supply problem?
Yeah, this is the water house.
Yeah, I think everybody's moving out. They must want your homes. They'll probably move into them next week and change the rules for
themselves.
Frank lives
on the East Coast. I'm down for living, but the West Coast, I have no interest in.
Yeah, there you go.
Virginia sounds beautiful. I've heard some descriptions. I've seen pictures. I wouldn't mind living there.
Yeah.
But California, I don't know. Count me out.
Yeah, okay. Well, then I won't.
Well, you go pack your boxes. It sounds like you've got a worse weekend ahead of you than I do.
Oh, worse than you can ever imagine.
I don't even want to think about it.
No, you don't want to think
about it. I'm glad I don't live near you.
Yeah, I would have you over.
Yes, Vince, you would, too.
I'm already helping one friend move this weekend.
Share the burden. All right, guys. Good night. Thank you.
See you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.